Thanks for joining us. It's our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top news stories of the week with my colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me here in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
And expected to join us a little bit later will be Tim Wood, the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle, and Nelson Sigelman should call in from, he's the managing editor at the Martha's Vineyard Times. And now we'll take a look at some of the news here on the Cape and Islands. It's been a busy week, and one of the big stories this week is about campaigns. We're already looking ahead to the governor's campaign and local races as well, and I guess it all depends on what happens with Senator Dan Wolf.
Well, if this ethics commission would ever make a ruling, then we would have an answer on this. And so,
okay, let's give the background on what Senator Wolf is facing here.
Okay, so Senator Wolf has been in the Senate for 2.5 years. He, as everyone around here knows, has been the founder and head of Cape Air, which has these contracts, if you will, with Logan Airport, which is their main sort of hub. And the Ethics Commission, even though the head of the Ethics Commission or the executive director of the Ethics Commission used to be one of the chief legal counsel at Massport, who owns and operates the airport, somehow it took the Ethics Commission 2.5 years to figure out that Dan Wolf, who had been in the state Senate, had the standard sort of boilerplate contracts, which no one disputes. They're not something that you negotiate. They're something that are set by the federal government. Any airline that accesses Logan Airport has to pay these fees. The point Dan Wolf has been trying to make, or I should also mention, of course, that the Ethics Commission ruled a few months after he announced that he was running for governor that there was a conflict of interest, and not only, and so they presented him with the choice. They said, either you can't run for governor, you can't be a state senator, and work for Cape Air. You either have to divest. He has about a 20% ownership stake in an employee-owned company. Either you have to divest or you have to get out of politics. And a lot of people, including, you know, people who aren't necessarily in his political camp, thought that was a real problem. And so he has appealed to the Ethics Commission months ago. And earlier this week, they held a hearing and decided to kick the can down the road another month. And so meanwhile, State Senator Dan Wolf has suspended his gubernatorial campaign. He remains a state senator. And with this story about campaign dominoes is that when he announced that he was running for governor, State Rep Sarah Peek out there in Provincetown on the Outer Cape thought it'd be a good idea to announce that she'd like to run for his seat as a state senator.
Sure.
And then you had Ed McManus, who was a Democratic selectman out of Harwich, who was thinking about running for State Rep Sarah Peek's seat. And you also had Leo Kukunis, a Republican, who was also thinking about running for State Rep Sarah Peek's seat. So now, of course, nobody knows what's going on. So there was this hearing earlier this week with the Ethics Commission, and it sounds like, even though they won't say what the four exemption proposals, it sounds like the Ethics Commission is moving in the direction of crafting some kind of exemption that it sounds like, at a minimum, will allow Dan Wolf to retain his state Senate seat. Now, the question remains, would it be different for governors? And the whole idea behind this, and, you know, State Senator Dan Wolf has gotten judges and prominent lawyers and business people sort of behind him who have also let the commission know that, listen, this conflict of interest law was aimed at state office holders who are negotiating contracts with the state, not situations in which there is no room for negotiation. It sounds like the Ethics Commission is wrapping their mind around that now. The problem I think they're dealing with, it sounds based on Ryan Barber's reporting, is that they don't want to make the exemption seem like it was crafted specifically for Dan Wolf, that they want to use Dan Wolf's situation to address this sort of gap in between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law.
I see. And so they decided, look, we have a new chairperson coming in next month. Let's hold off, and we'll readdress this next month. Until then, you can stay in the Senate, Senator Wolf. No clarity on whether you can run for governor, but until then, at least you can stay in the Senate. I was interested. They were talking about four different proposals or exemptions that the staff of the commission had come up with. They're discussing these in a public meeting,
mm-hmm.
and then a reporter goes and asks to see what they are.
And they say, we can't show it to you, and they cite some arcane, you know, aspect of open records law saying, we can't tell you what those other proposals are.
Okay.
So, right. You know, the Ethics Commission is an important body, and although this is an interesting story because I think it does, in a lot of people's minds, and I've talked to some people who feel like it sort of casts doubts on the workings of the Ethics Commission, sort of the murky character, and this story, and particularly that aspect that you mentioned about not even sharing what the proposals are in a body that's supposed to be about transparency.
What's the ethics there?
And so I don't know. It's kind of a mess. And meanwhile, as you can imagine, State Senator Dan Wolf doesn't know if he'll run for re-election even as state senator. Certainly, his campaign as governor looks like it's suspended. But the longer this goes on, the less likely it becomes that he'll be able to stay in the race. And then you throw in the fact that Attorney General Martha Coakley's running for governor. And
right.
If I was a betting man, I would say that all of this amounts to curtains for his gubernatorial campaign, although he still may remain to be a state senator. Because I think part of the reason he doesn't want to divest the companies, I think he is worried about not only the financial implications for himself, but also how that would work out with, you know, this employee-owned airline that he operates.
Mm. Let's move on to the next story. A lot of homeowners are thinking about their insurance after these new flood maps came out from the federal government. Now, the federal government has been on hiatus for a week or so here, so I haven't been able to get a lot of information about these flood maps as different towns look at them, but all sorts of stories popping up across the state, including in the Cape Cod Times, with people realizing that their new insurance rates could be tens of thousands more than what they're currently paying.
With the possibility of pushing, you know, people out of their homes and these kind of things. And, you know, not only was the federal government on hiatus, State Attorney General Martha Coakley and House Speaker Bob DeLeo are hoping that this bill that they are going to introduce, or that they are introducing, will put these FEMA maps sort of on a hiatus a bit. And what they're proposing is legislation that would prohibit mortgage companies from actually requiring homeowners to purchase flood insurance in amounts that are, you know, that exceed the outstanding balance of their loans. And it also would prohibit mortgage companies from requiring that contents within the home be covered by the insurance, or make it a requirement that the deductible be less than $5,000. So these are some of the measures that they hope will bring some relief to some homeowners, because I think state officials, certainly local officials, get it that this is an unbelievable shock and financial burden, and in some instances would really make it, you know, there's no possible way that people could go from paying $600 in insurance premiums to $10,000. It's just absurd. You know, and so they're hoping to try to, you know, craft this legislation in a way that will help. Now, the thing that was interesting about this story that Patrick Cassidy wrote is that he spoke to some folks in the real estate business who said, you know, A for effort, nice try, but none of this stuff is really going to matter much. It's not going to really really cut down on some of the huge premiums and expenses that people are looking at. So
right. And I think that Coakley and DeLeo were both quite honest, saying this isn't really the solution. This is all we can really kind of put together here at the state level. We really need Congress to make some sort of change. This was mandated out of Sandy after Hurricane Sandy. Congress said, look, you got to look at these flood maps and see who's really in the right zone and who isn't.
And also being driven by the fact that the fund that pays flood insurance or covers flood insurance for for millions and millions of homeowners is in a severe financial hole. I think something like $30 billion or something. So part of this is being driven by how can we fill that hole back up?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds like they think the best way to do it is on the backs of homeowners. And so that's where they are now. It's really unclear where this is going to go from here. It doesn't sound as if FEMA is even considering reexamining this. And you know, for local homeowners, and this has been an issue for years, actually, on the Cape, one of the things that's frustrating is the models that are used to determine what areas are in flood risk areas. They're considered proprietary information, so to speak, and so therefore they can't be shared with people. So the pricing models, the storm models that are being used to generate this is all sort of being kept secret, and the insurance companies are basically saying, trust us, nothing's going on here. Mm. We're just raising your rates ridiculously high. And a lot of people think that the models that they are using are based on models out of Florida. That's a different situation than the Cape.
Right.
And therefore are not appropriate to be used in this region. So
right. We've heard this a lot around the hurricane modeling. You can't get a look at it. The insurance company holds on to that information. Meanwhile, here on the Cape anyway, we haven't really been struck by many hurricanes, but our insurance seems to go up every year. Let's just a minute here. That should give us enough time to talk about the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, which I believe is still powered down. I checked with the NRC yesterday afternoon. Of course, the NRC spokesperson had been on furlough,
mm-hmm.
but it looked like an update yesterday on the site. It was still down.
Well, one of the NSTAR poles that at a substation in Carver that actually had been installed in May, it broke, and it caused a problem for the Pilgrim plant. They had to power down. Pilgrim officials aren't really saying how much by how far, but this is just sort of the latest in a long string of incidences that we're hearing in which that plant has had to power down or have had alarms go off and things of that nature. And so
right.
Here we are once again, and certainly we'll give much more fodder for critics who say this plant should be shut down because it's old.
Well, they lost off-site power. That's a major situation for a nuclear power plant, but luckily the backup generators were able to take care of that. We're going to take just a minute break here. When we come back, we'll talk with Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup. We discuss the top news stories of the week. I'm Sean Corcoran, and with me in the Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist at the Cape Cod Times. Joining us on the phone is Tim Wood, editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Sean.
Tim, let's talk about the story you have in the paper this week regarding the police considering using tasers in town.
Yeah, this is a story from Chatham. A few months ago, the Chatham police found themselves in a situation where they faced a despondent man wielding a knife. It was one of those situations they sometimes refer to as suicide by cop, where a desperate person threatens officers in the hopes that they'll use lethal force to restrain him. They ultimately used pepper spray to subdue this man, but they still had to struggle with the knife, which worried Police Chief Mark Paulina. He was worried that this put his men at risk, so he asked the department's firearm instructor to evaluate the use of tasers by the department and to come back with a recommendation. Now, we all know that tasers fire a dart that delivers a 50,000-volt jolt to a suspect, immobilizing a person just long enough for the police to subdue them. Paulina is interested in knowing if this would be a safer way for officers to respond to situations like the recent one. And as you know, also a number of Cape departments already use tasers, including Harwich, which bought 11 of the devices in 2011. Chief Paulina is expecting a report on this any day now, really.
Have any of the town boards or commissions taken a look at this?
Not at this point. This was something that hasn't really been discussed across the board yet. The selectmen have not weighed in on it.
Would they need to? Would this be a policy they would need to weigh in on, or is it just this the chief's call?
I don't think so. I think this is the chief's call. It would be a department policy. Probably the town manager might have some say in it, but my sense is that she would defer to the chief on this one.
Right. Anything else on that topic?
At this point, we're waiting for the report, and there's been some chatter about this around town, as you can well imagine. Chatham's kind of a sleepy town, and some people are kind of wondering, do they really need tasers in this department? And others are saying, well, it's part of the arsenal that can keep our officers safe. As you know, in the summer, things can get a little hairy around here with partying and such, and the police often find themselves in these type of situations.
Sure. Often when the towns go through these types of discussions, the concern is that are the tasers safe enough, because there have been some reports around the country of people having heart attacks when getting hit by these things. So, but of course, you got to weigh it against what are the police facing.
Right, right. And there are some concerns. I know there was a report recently that that found that there have been some 500 or so taser-related deaths over the past decade across the country, you know, people with poor hearts or something like that getting hit by this kind of jolt. Mm. It would be quite a shock.
Okay. Let's talk about the Monomoy High School construction is going on, but there's some disruption to a nearby neighborhood. What's that?
Yeah, this is an interesting story. I guess you'd file this one under sort of unintended consequences. Residents of a quiet neighborhood in Harwich, located between Route 124 and Oak Street, which is where the new high school is being built, they suddenly found their quiet neighborhood disrupted by large trucks hauling construction material to the high school building site around the corner. Initially, officials couldn't figure out why trucks were using that route rather than going from Route 6 to Queen Anne Road and Oak Street, which is the more common route and has larger roads. It's not this neighborhood. Harwood Avenue is narrow roads and quiet residential streets. But then Police Chief William Mason drove to Exit 10 on Route 6 and set his GPS for Monomoy High School, and Harwood Avenue is the route it took him.
Oh.
Basically, they figured out that these trucks were from off Cape, and the drivers were depending upon their GPS to get them to the high school site, and that was taking them through the residential neighborhood. So since then, the town has ordered signs that basically they're going to put up at the intersection of Queen Anne Road and Route 124, which say, point down Queen Anne Road and say, Monomoy building site this way. And hopefully that will divert the truck traffic away from the quiet neighborhood. And those signs should be going up any day now.
Well, sounds like an easy fix.
Hopefully, yeah. The residents are hopeful that that's going to happen, too.
Any word on the library that had been closed because of mold?
Yeah, the Chatham Library opened about a week ago. They had a very sort of marathon cleaning session. They had a professional cleaner come in and scrub everything and you know, seal the basement floor that where moisture had been seeping up and causing carpets to get moldy. And they are still working on some of that. They haven't completely restored all the programs that they would normally have in the basement, but the library is open. It's people are using it, and everybody seems happy.
There you go. Tim Wood is the editor of the Cape Cod Chronicle. He joins us here on the News Roundup each week, and we're grateful for that. Tim, thanks very much.
Thanks, John. Have a good day.
You too. Sean Gonsalves is with me here in Woods Hole in our studio. He's a news columnist with the Cape Cod Times. Sean, one of the stories we've been following is the sandwich pool situation. Now, this is a pool in the high school, but it's used
by the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it truly is. It's been having some mechanical issues, and they're trying to sort through that now. We don't even know if it's going to continue at all.
Right, and I think this is sort of the sink or swim moment for this pool. It's been a source of some contention in town. There's, you know, there was a few years ago, there, you know, with the school budget being stretched thin, and the fact that a lot of senior residents and community people use the pool. In fact, some people say that they use it more than any of the high school kids do. And then there was that whole issue with you know, sharing the locker room, so to speak,
and then they
settled that. And, you know, for a lot of people, this pool has been, you know, sandwich swim team and some of the activities around the pool have been great for the town. But yet it's been, like most pools, they're expensive for upkeep. And this pool in particular has had some maintenance issues. And so this what the selectmen are looking to do is at their town meeting that's scheduled for November 18th, followed by a special election a few days later on November 21st, they're floating this Prop 2.5 capital exclusion, asking residents for $980,000. The Board of Selectmen voted to put this on the town meeting warrant as well as the ballot, because, of course, it needs to pass both in order for this
it'll be a, it'll raise taxes in town for the year of this loan, essentially, that they're looking to get for $980,000, which actually happens to be the more expensive of the two fix-it options that the town was looking at. And, you know, you've got Selectman Frank Panorfi, who was saying, listen, this pool work stuff, it's not an emergency. We've got bigger fish to fry in terms of town needs and town infrastructure. You've got Selectman Susan James, who's saying that, look, the problems with this pool in terms of the maintenance now, they were unanticipated. We can't really hold it. You know, we have to be ready to deal with unanticipated things. So the way they'd like to deal with it. And then there was a little bit of debate with the Board of Selectmen. There's some other maintenance costs that they need to deal with at the school. There's one of the wings of the school where the windows are all messed up and and the dripping. And so then they had a discussion about whether or not they should lump that $650,000 needed for separate repairs that have nothing to do with the pool and the $980,000 pool repairs, if to sort of put it as one big, hey, voters, why don't you give us all of this money to do all of the repairs at all of the different things at the high school? The selectmen finally decided that it was a better idea to separate the two, to give voters that choice to tackle the pool issue, which essentially means if the voters reject that money for the pool, I suppose it means the voters are willing, or the town, you know, the town is willing to basically say the pool's not, it doesn't mean that much then. We're not going to, you know, for us to, you know, this is a town, by the way, that I believe has the highest tax rate on the Cape.
I think you're right.
It's a town that often chafes under tax issues. And so I'm sure there are, you know, there's a contingent of folks in town who'd like to see the pool, you know, put a plug in the pool, drain it, put a plug in the pool, and let's move on. There's a lot of people that see it as a community asset who say, listen, what are we going to do? We've got to pay for this. And so here we are now at this moment with the pool there in Sandwich, and voters are going to have their say November 18th, and then they're going to have to follow that up, though, with the November 21st vote at the polls.
Right. And it might seem strange that a pool would be a major issue in a community, but this is the pool not only of the students using it for their swim teams and their diving and such, but and the older folks often in the morning going in there.
Mm-hmm. Swimming but lessons, all
the
kinds
swimming
of stuff.
Lessons. Mm-hmm. I mean, the children in town have been learning how to swim in this pool for a long time. So, and of course, it's interesting when you have a town meeting, a lot of times what you do get when there's a school issue on the agenda, you're going to get parents, and they're often going to vote for it. But as you seem to indicate there, things can change when they go to the polls. It isn't always the same people.
And we've seen that in other towns where it'll pass at a town meeting. And, you know, sometimes it comes down to nobody wants to be the bad guy, really, at town meeting sometimes and say no to something that's popular. And then when people get behind the curtain in the poll,
right,
they vote their conscience or vote what they think is right, and sometimes it's often in conflict with what happened at town meeting.
Well, we'll keep the audience well informed about what happens with the Sandwich Pool. Let's talk about Barnstable. They have a shooting range in Barnstable. I don't know of a lot of communities that have their own shooting range, but this one's been shut down for a couple of years, and now they want to open it back up.
Yeah, it was shut down for a couple of years and this is a town-owned shooting range, so you're right. It's a little unusual that, you know, a town would have its own shooting range. And there were some activities, I guess, going on there. I'm not exactly clear what. I think people were sort of going out there with, you know, apparently there was some system where people were given keys or something.
Right, that was the system. There was no, from my reading, there was no one there overseeing the shooting range at all times. But if you paid for a membership, you got a key and you could go and use it, and you were left to your own, you're left on your own to actually use it during the correct hours. And so there were some complaints, I guess, that people were using that shooting range outside of the established hours.
Outside of the established hours. And then there's also concern among town officials as to what that would imply for the town's insurance.
Right. They found out there was no insurance at the shooting range.
Yeah,
so they had to shut it down.
And so now they do. And so there's certain requirements that come with the insurance. But so they've had these two meetings, both of them very well attended. The last one was earlier this week. There were over 100 folks there or so. And so what the Conservation Commission was trying to establish is what should the operating hours be, and should they be raising the fees to become a member? They decided, I'm sure to the chagrin of some of the neighbors, and by the way, the shooting range is basically off the service road over there by exit 5. in the town of Barnstable. There were neighbors, of course, who were concerned about hearing gunshots all the time in and around their, not in, but around their house, I should say. And you know, noise and these kind of things are always a concern, particularly gunshots. It's a little unnerving to hear gunshots unless you happen to be out on the range having fun, shooting targets and what have you. And one of the proposals that town staff had was, let's open the range basically 3 days a week,
right,
including one day on the weekend. Of course, people that are really into shooting at the range, so that's ridiculous to have it open 3 days. We want it open 7 days a week. So in essence, the Barnstable Conservation Commission, I suppose, you know, voted for a compromise for it to be open to the public 5 days a week, including the weekend. And also, and then Monday and Tuesday, I think the Barnstable police, you know, have access to it when the public doesn't. So in essence, it sounds to me as if you're a neighbor around there, that there's going to be somebody at that shooting range every single day of the week. And then they also raised the fees. I think they went from, what, $25 for residents to, I think they're thinking of like 90, because what they plan on doing is having either a certified safety instructor or a police officer at the shooting range whenever it's open. So that is where they are with it at the moment. And, you know, they hope to get this shooting range up and open very soon.
Well, we'll finish with this. We can move on from the shooting range. But it does appear to be a moneymaker. Did you see some of the amounts that it makes? $8,000 to run the shooting range, and this is from 2010 to 2011. And then they took in $41,000.
Right.
So that's pretty good. That's pretty good. $33,000 in profit.
And that was with the old fees. And
yeah,
you know, with the new fees, they're not quite sure. I think they're going to revisit within 90 days the fee structure. They're not quite clear if the fees make sense given you know, the number of people that go there. But I'm quite sure that the town in part wants to open this because, as you say, it is a revenue enhancer for the town.
Right. Let's move on. Let's talk about there's work underway to craft an island-wide let's talk about the tourist train. That's what I like to call it. I guess
it is the tourist train.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no one denies that it was set up to try to attract tourists. Remember, they had the press conference at South Station and the different business and officials and legislators. They rolled out this campaign to let folks know, hey, don't drive down to the Cape. Take the train from Boston down to the Cape and, you know, cut down on some of the traffic. And it worked to a large extent, a lot better than they had hoped for. They got more passengers than they had anticipated. It brought in more revenue than they anticipated. And they ended up, remember, extending it from, it was initially going to run until just the end of the summer season. They decided to extend it into October. Now they're thinking about, you know, possibly expanding it a bit more, meaning, you know, adding a stop by the canal, because they found that I think something like 25% of the people that took that train down here were actually going over to the islands.
Oh,
and
right.
So if you put a stop in the canal region, you know, it can sort of, you know, allow those people to move on to the island a little bit easier. Coming down through here in Woods Hole. And then also, Wendy Northcross, who is the head of the Cape Cod Chamber of Commerce, was saying not only should it be a weekend train service, but we should, you know, also do it for Thursday. Because if you do it for Thursday night, people can come down here for these extended weekends and so forth. They haven't figured out all of the details of that. Of course, it requires for them to get permission from the state. I'm sure it requires you know to talk to MBTA officials and the folks that run the train and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the Cape's been pretty lucky because we have Tom Kerr here. He's a former co-chairman of the House Joint Committee on Transportation. I mean, he mixes up with those transportation folks, state transportation people. He was able to get this thing going as a pilot program, and he's been the brains behind it. And boy, what a success. Some of the numbers, just I think the total number of people who used it was about 17,000 people. For just this summer.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think this is something that we'll probably see again next summer. It's interesting. You're right. Tom Kahir is a very knowledgeable person about all these issues. Of course, now he's sort of the unofficial transportation czar, if you will, for this area. But one of the things that's also interesting, because sometimes people see this and go,
yeah, what, you know, but there should be commuter rail, because the real way to cut down on traffic is to get actual people that live here on the Cape to use the train to go back and forth off Cape and these kind of things. But Tom Cahir, that's where he sort of draws the line in the sand. I've had conversations with him about this, and is clear that it's one thing to have a tourist train, if you will, in the summer, but commuter rail that runs constantly year-round is a whole different animal, and it presents a lot of challenges that he thinks are probably insurmountable, really, for the Cape. First of all, the track infrastructure doesn't really allow for it here. I mean, the trains on the Cape have to travel relatively slow. I think something 25, 30 miles an hour. If you're on vacation and you're moseying down to the Cape and you're taking into the sights, a three-hour train trip from Boston to Hyannis isn't that big of a deal, I guess. When you're commuting back and forth to work, 3 hours or so, it's like, maybe not. So that's one issue. The other issue is the train tracks happen to run through a very nice part of the Cape that have a lot of very nice homes in that area. And I believe to have a real commuter line, they would need to revamp and expand some of the infrastructure. Now you're running into some issues with residents and property owners. There's all kinds of other issues. And so in his mind, it's great to have this tourist train. Bad idea for a commuter rail. The Cape just really isn't big enough for that. And by the way, to do that type of work and prep work, he thinks would be prohibitively expensive at a time when, you know, everybody's running around, you know, looking for pinching pennies, looking for budgets for, you know, a whole host of other issues, transportation needs. So the likelihood of this becoming a commuter train seem slim to none, at least at the moment. Who knows what's on the horizon down the road, but that I think it will remain a tourist train for the, you know, foreseeable future.
He did seem more open to the idea if it emerged from Buzzards Bay. So if it went to the other side of the canal.
Oh, sure, and I should have mentioned that, because that's the other thing he said, is that it's not that he's like philosophically opposed and thinks commuter rail is a bad idea in general. He's just talking about the logistics of it coming across that bridge.
Right.
But I do think he is a supporter of extending the commuter rail down into Buzzards Bay. But then when you think about that in the grand scheme of things, I mean, they've been talking about extending the commuter rail into New Bedford for about, I don't know, my entire life.
No, it's unbelievable, the voters in New Bedford. Every time there's an election, we're going to bring that train down here, and then it doesn't happen. And Tom did make a good point. He said this tourist train has proven that people will take the train. And it was a big question when we started off. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to talk to Nelson Siegelman about all the happenings on Martha's Vineyard. Welcome back to the News Roundup. I'm Sean Corcoran. With me in our Woods Hole studio is Sean Gonsalves. He's a news columnist with the Cape Cod Times. Joining us on the phone is Nelson Siegelman. He's the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, Nelson.
Good morning.
Let's talk about the Steamship Authority. Members approved a new budget for 2014. That includes a few rate hikes and some capital projects. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, they're going to hike the cost of parking in the Woods Hole lot, and they're going to hike truck fares. Now, they say that both of these fares haven't gone up for some time, and they're basically trying to fill a hole in their budget for next year. And the way the Steamship Authority works, each route has to pay for their cost of service. So, for example, if Nantucketers want an extra boat here or there, they have to end up covering that cost, the same with the Vineyard. That wasn't always the case. In fact, years ago, Vineyard traffic subsidized Nantucket service, and eventually the Vineyard member brought that to their attention, and they changed the formula. So we'll see rate increases. And it's interesting, if you look at the traffic statistics, that traffic has dropped in the first 9 months of this year, so for all but trucks. So they're going to try and make up this budget shortfall with those increases.
How are the passenger numbers? Was there any discussion about that?
What they did is they released the numbers for the year-to-date September, and there was a increase overall, but about a 0.4% decrease from the same period last year in terms of passengers to the Vineyard, and that was about 1,800,000 8,000 passengers. A lot of people travel back and forth, but you know, passengers pay the fares, and that's what subsidizes the Steamship Authority.
And real quick, for people who don't know, the Steamship Authority isn't a government agency, right? Quasi-government? How does this work?
It's a quasi-government agency. It's an authority, but basically the Steamship Authority has to cover its cost of service. It's not, for example, like the MBTA, it does not receive any money from state taxpayers. So it's... the other thing people may not understand is the Steamship Authority has a license to operate, or can issue licenses for any other ferries to operate between the mainland and the Vineyard. The idea is that because the authority has to operate all year round, even in the off season, they cannot have someone coming in and siphoning off basically the summer months, which would then affect the Steamship Authority's bottom line.
Hmm. Okay. Another story in the paper this week is about the work underway to craft an island-wide fertilizer regulations, and this is after some work at the state level.
Well, yes, the state is going to be issuing new regulations for fertilizer use and really guidelines, I suppose. But there is an opportunity for the Cape and Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard to add to those regulations, and we have a group on the Vineyard that's now looking at how these regulations might be strengthened. You know, it's interesting if you fly over, for example, Martha's Vineyard, and you look at some of these lawns, even in the off-season, you have these emerald green lawns ringing some of our salt ponds and other water bodies, and of course, these lawns are green because they're well fertilized, and all of that fertilizer does affect the quality of salt ponds and our bays and ultimately shellfish, and has a lot of other ramifications. So, of course, I never fertilize my lawn, and luckily everything dies. I don't have to cut it, so I'm...
I see. So
cod lawn.
So the Cape and the islands are able to make their regulations a little bit stricter.
They can add to these state regulations and make them and strengthen them.
Well, that's nice to recognize that the Cape and the islands is a pretty distinct area that probably needs different regulations than, say, Worcester.
Right, and Nantucket already has created regulations that are, in fact, fairly stringent.
I see. Nelson, any other stories in the paper that you wanted to talk about this week?
Well, I think this business of registered marijuana dispensaries is sort of interesting. You know, this law went into effect. I think a lot of towns across Massachusetts are going to be trying to sort out what they should do with these dispensaries, where they should go, how they should operate. It's not a case now of just saying no. The law allows for them. And I know on the Vineyard, both in West Tisbury and Oak Bluffs, they're talking about where they should go and who should be the permitting authority and how this will operate. And as a sort of sidebar to that, the local police now, who have spent an awful lot of time over the years going after people who are dealing marijuana, growing marijuana, I don't know if this happened on the Cape, but for a number of years in the summer, we used to have one of these black helicopters go over the island looking for places where people were growing pot, and then the local police would go and destroy the crop.
Right.
You have to question whether or not that's going to be occurring anymore in the future. Why would they spend all that time and energy? So,
Right. I believe the law, not only does it allow these dispensaries a certain amount in each county, but it also allows individuals to receive permission to grow a certain number of plants.
I think that you're right.
Medical,
yeah.
If they have basically a note from a doctor.
Right. They get their license or their prescription to grow.
Nelson, has there been any talk over on the island, this is Sean Gonsalves, about establishing moratoriums, or have those been created? I know in a lot of towns on the Cape, that's sort of been their tool to
hold
us off.
Last year they did at our round of annual town meetings. It was sort of a mixed bag. Some of the towns approved it, some did not. But those moratoriums only last up to a year. You have to, you know...
Right.
Couldn't delay this forever. Now that's what's occurring. The towns are coming to grips with this. And, of course, the Department of Public Health is getting ready to issue 35 licenses statewide. I believe the law allows for not more than 4 or 5 per county, but you have to have at least one. And we have 4 applicants from the from the vineyard, and presumably one of them will get a license. I doubt, for example, if all 4 would,
right?
Just because of the initial limit they have on 35 statewide.
Well, communities about 15, 20 years ago went through a similar process when the Supreme Judicial Court said, look, you can't exclude adult bookstores from your communities. So they had to set up specific places where these things could go. And presumably, that would be the same type of area that a marijuana dispensary.
It seems like a lot of towns are looking at, you know, places that are already
areas.
Industrial park, right. Sort of areas. And Dennis, of the towns on the Cape anyway, is a lot further ahead than the other towns. I wouldn't quite call it Amsterdam or something yet, but they seem to be a little bit further down the road.
And Mashpee will be voting at their town meeting next week. And when you read the item, it there's a lot of security involved, a lot of regulations regarding signage and lighting and all those sorts of things. So it sounds like towns and, of course, Martha Vineyard are taking these things pretty seriously. You also looked at what happened in Rhode Island, didn't you, Nelson?
One of our reporters took a visit to Rhode Island and went to one of their 3 registered marijuana dispensaries, and that's described in this week's paper. And they, you know, it's some ways like going into a fine wine shop, I guess. They have various labels for this type of marijuana and that type of marijuana, and all the paraphernalia. And it's, you know, those of us who are a bit older, it's hard not to think about 20, 30 years ago when rolling papers suddenly started making an appearance in stores. And, of course, there's only one general reason why people were buying rolling papers. And
to roll their own cigarettes.
Right. Yeah, right. And so now, you know, it's become a real growth industry, I suppose. And it's hard not to think that this is a lot of energy being poured into this whole effort to provide marijuana to people who need it for medical purposes, and the associated effects with people who still just want to go out and smoke marijuana recreationally, and that ultimately has an effect on the police effort. So this is going to be an interesting situation to watch in Massachusetts as it continues to develop.
That's right. Nelson Siegelman, he's the managing editor of the Martha's Vineyard Times. You can go check it out online or pick up the paper this week. Thank you, Nelson.
Thank you.
Sean Gonzalez with me in our Woods Hole studio. We talked about the tourist train and the hopes for that and what that proved itself to be this summer. Let's talk about the Bourne Scallop Festival. That's a big tourist attraction that was just fairly recently. Well, it's not going to be the Bourne Scallop Festival anymore.
Now it's just going to be, I don't know what the name of the new festival is.
It's
going to
be the Scallop Fest.
Scallop Fest, right. That's because it's moving to the Cape Cod Fairgrounds, which are in East Falmouth, no longer. First of all, it's on this side of the bridge and not even in the town of Bourne any longer. And you know something? This is kind of sad for the town of Bourne, I think, in a lot of ways.
It's one of the reasons. Every year, you know you're going to get thousands of people in that downtown, which doesn't see a lot of action.
It doesn't.
Anymore.
And you know, it used to be a pretty happening place,
yeah.
That little area. And you know, even to this day, I've long thought this. I don't live in the town of Bourne, by the way, but I just feel like it's an area of the Cape that you could just imagine being this really attractive area. You know, it's right along the canal. It's beautiful. You've got the Mass Maritime Academy at one end. You know, down at the other end, you've got the Rotary and a lot of different restaurants. I think the issue really is the infrastructure is simply not there in that part of town. It's very expensive, I know, but years ago when I was asking about this, just thinking about the potential of that area, I think it actually has the potential of being one of the nicest main streets on the Cape, at least from a tourist perspective, you know, considering the backdrop and the surrounding environs. But the lack of wastewater treatment or sewage in that area, I think, is what is prevented real development in that area. And the town has made all of these efforts over the years, you know, these revitalization mm-hmm. campaigns, and
yeah.
They've tried to spruce up the area. You know, they've redone some of the buildings. I think they've redone some of the sidewalks. But in this particular instance,
I think the Cape Cod Regional Chamber of Commerce, who's festival this has been for decades, that town-owned green area where they've held the festival, they've had a lot of problems because of, you know, when they're putting up the stakes and the different, you know, porta potties and different things like that. It just really hasn't been conducive to the Scallop Fest, and so they've decided that let's go to the fairgrounds and where, you know, that's a place that's made to host big events, and none of the problems that we've had will we have at the fairgrounds. It sounds like it was done, you know, even the head of the chamber, the Canal Area Chamber, Marie Oliva, you know, it sounded like she had a little bit of sadness too. I don't think this was something that they were looking to get out of town, like, right. Oh, we just want to get out of here.
They have 50,000 people come into this event each year. They're having problems with the tents flying away. There have been complaints about sewage in the past. That wasn't in the article, but I'm aware of those complaints as well. So they're moving it to the Cape Cod Fairgrounds, not to be called the Barnstable County Fairgrounds anymore. It's the
right.
Cape Cod Fairgrounds.
That's right.
September 19th through the 21st next year.
Route 151.
Right on Route 151. Quickly, speaking of Route 151, we just have a few minutes left here. I want to talk about this church on 151 to drive by. You think it might be a performing arts center or some sort of a college or something like that, but indeed it's going to be a church when it's finished, and what an impressive church it is.
It is, and it's certainly one of the more unique-looking church buildings on the Cape, and that was by design. The church pastor there, Ben Feldot, who him and his wife, you know, this church started in his living room, really, in Falmouth.
Two decades ago.
Cape Cod Church is what we're talking about. It's currently located on T-Ticket Highway in East Falmouth, and it's grown so much that they've really have burst out of the church. They have several different services. They've got about 1,200 members, about 600 or 700, you know, will attend a service on any given Sunday. It's a lot of folks.
What was interesting was the average age of the parishioner is 33.
Right.
Now, we know here on Cape Cod, there aren't a lot of 33-year-olds with
churchgoers.
Families.
Yeah.
I don't know about the churchgoers, but just that demographic is very low.
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like they're really gearing this church to families.
Well, they are. With mochas and fireplaces and heated floors and all of these gleaming modern accoutrements, you know, where the message from the pulpit's going to be, you know, sent out all through the church, and then you've got, you know, Wi-Fi access for people that want to use their iPads for Bibles. It's by design, they want to make this church, this futuristic church that can be here. They want to be forward looking. They didn't want to necessarily take it out of the mold of the sort of the classic Cape Cod church with the white steeple.
Right.
And you're right. I drove by it this morning. It looks like some performing arts center, and that is, you know, on purpose. They want it to be a place in addition to where people are more normally at home or at work. They want to make this church a sort of a third place where at least their congregation members can really gather and support one another. They've got all kinds of programs there. So it's a massive project. It's a 40,000 square foot building. It's on 10 acres of land, and it's an $8 million project, a lot of which, or at least half of which, was raised by church members themselves.
Yeah, I think they raised $5 million already, so that's a good chunk, $3 million borrowed. I liked the heated floors in the infant room and the indoor jungle gym, as well as the soccer field. I mean, it sounds like quite a church. And
there's a coffee bar, you know.
We'll stop over there after the news roundup. And a solar array on the roof, which should take care of most of the facility's energy needs.
Right. Right. So, you know, it's an interesting concept and one that I'm sure will attract a lot of eyes, especially in that area. You drive by, you're not expecting to see, and all of a sudden, bam, it's like, whoa, what is that? And it's a church.
Right across from the fairgrounds there. And now you know what's happening across from the fairgrounds, what that building is. And that's what's happening on the Cape and the Islands. Sean Gonsalves joined me here in the Woods Hole studio. Thank you, Sean. You're a columnist for the Cape Cod Times. Three times a week?
Three times a week. Check me out this Sunday. Thanks a lot. Good to be here.
And you can also pick up the paper or go to Cape Cod Online. Great thanks to Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle and Nelson Siegelman from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you to them for calling in. And I want to thank you for listening. I'm Sean Corcoran.